It's the Burt Cohen Show. The dream of America. How exceptional is the American dream? How unique really are we? What does history have to say about the concept of American exceptionalism? You know, you travel all across this country and you hear politicians say, America is the greatest country in the world. Well, I always figure that's because they've never visited Italy. I've been to Italy. It's a beautiful place. And our guest today on the Burt Cohen Show are Andrew Burstein and Nancy Eisenberg, professors of history at Louisiana State University and co-authors of a Random House published book on Madison and Jefferson, some of the founders of this country who I'm sure didn't agree on everything. Well, thanks very much, Andrew and Nancy, for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show. We keep hearing this term, American exceptionalism. Newt Gingrich is talking about it a little bit these days as he gears up for a run at the White House. What is American exceptionalism?
Well, American exceptionalism has become something of a litmus test. And what we contend is that it's entirely bogus, this idea that, and it suits those who want to declare America a godly nation, a Christian nation in its inception. It's all of a piece. Our consideration is that conservatives have been very selective in what they pluck from 18th century documents in order to suggest that there's a straight line, and it began with the Declaration of Independence and the Revolution, and this understanding that, you know, America was providentially constructed, that you know, that city on a hill, this right, site of unusual or extraordinary virtue, and you know, as you're suggesting about you know, going to other countries and seeing other cultures and understanding what's happened in recent years is that American exceptionalism has become kind of a slogan, a way of saying that our founding documents have associated us with some sort of God-given right to dictate morally to the rest of the world.
Hmm. Now, where did this phrase come from, American exceptionalism? And I'm reminded, of course, of the phrase, the city on the hill. I pardon my memory here. Where does that phrase come from, city on a hill? And is that really the origin of the notion of American exceptionalism?
Well, that goes back to John Winthrop as part of the Puritan community who considered themselves exiles because of their religious faith and that somehow they were coming to this new world. And this was very popular, this idea that America was a new world, and Europeans thought about it even before they had explored it or knew anything about the American continent. So part of the mythology is that America is this land of abundance, although the older ideology also said it contained dangerous unknown qualities as well, which eventually would be attached to native peoples who were a threat to the European migration to the New World. Hmm. So, yes, the city on the hill, it in the Revolutionary period, is compared to the New Jerusalem. Oh. There are millennial overtones. They're attached during the French and Indian War to this idea of American exceptionalism. But what's odd about it is that American exceptionalism really begins in the period where we are still part of the British people. We are part of the system of the British Empire, British colonialism, and that idea is even promoted by people like Benjamin Franklin. I mean, part of one of the most important things with American exceptionalism is that we are this vast and open continent, this endless land. And this actually continues all the way through to the 20th century, that really what makes America unique is that we have a different labor system, we have more abundant land. This creates greater equality, greater liberty. But it actually was first articulated by Franklin when he is a proud, a member of the British Empire. So this is one of the troubling things that the contemporary people who invoke this term, they want to imagine that it's our creation story. We were created anew at the time of the American Revolution. But many of these ideas can be linked to our British ancestors and British traditions, so they're not necessarily unique.
In that context, the British precedent, you don't go from being loyal subjects of the crown in 1763, believing in the combined might and the unique collaboration between London and Philadelphia or Boston, the pride of being British. You don't go from there to being exceptionally anointed by God 13 years later in the Declaration of Independence, simply on the basis of a piece of propaganda, which is what the Declaration really was. I mean, that doesn't detract from its wonderful qualities, its political, cultural qualities, but it was designed to woo French support, to woo the support of Dutch bankers, and to rouse a militant spirit among the grunts that were needed to fight the most disciplined, well-equipped army on earth. So they needed, the patriots needed a story. And, so the Declaration of Independence, which is America's long-form birth certificate, is both more and less than what knee-jerk patriots would insist on.
We are talking on the Burt Cohen Show with Professors Andrew Burstein and Nancy Eisenberg about American exceptionalism. Now, whenever I hear the national anthems of other countries, there's kind of a similar feel. How great we are. We've had oppression. We are a unique people. And heck, we're just the best. So what makes America different on that? Don't they feel kind of special as well?
Yeah, you're right. Other countries have engaged in exceptionalism. A lot of scholars link exceptionalism to the idea of creating nation states, that it has its unique historical time period where this idea of celebrating the exceptional qualities, the unique qualities, you can find it in Germany. Scholars who write about the French Revolution and its unique qualities, and the British scholars. Linda Colley, one of the leading British scholars, has talked about the uniqueness of the British society between 1750 and 1830. So you're exactly right that exceptionalism has emerged in other countries. And I think if you look historically, there are moments where it becomes more pronounced. We also know that the very act of writing history is often driven by this sense of moral mission and ideology. And that's also shared, whether you're writing about the United States or whether you're writing about other countries. But it's always raises a question. What's interesting is, has this sense of moral mission been more peculiarly prominent in American culture? This is a question that's not only been imposed by American scholars, but even Europeanists and observers, of whether we've engaged in this celebration of exceptionalism even more than other countries. And part of it, it's often linked to claiming that we are a country without historical precedent.
Right.
That the way we were created at the time of the Revolution was so unique that people even have argued in the 19th century that it couldn't be duplicated or imitated from other countries. You know, trying to stress our singularity, our uniqueness, never to be duplicated again.
We are the first modern republic, and that is something special. But the enduring value of Jefferson's words or the writings of the founding generation, that doesn't entitle us to going around yelling mindlessly, we're number one. You don't inherit greatness. The founders would have said that. You earn it. you had asked when it was that the phrase American exceptionalism was first used, and the answer is surprising. It was first invoked in the early 1930s in Communist Party literature, describing America's labor system and how it was exceptional, with, you know, in relation to what communists had to do to attract a following in Europe.
Yeah, and I would add to that, I mean, one of the greatest promoters of American exceptionalism has been Irving Howe, and he sort of celebrated this idea that the reason that socialism didn't develop in the same way in the United States as it did in Europe was because of our uniqueness, and our uniqueness was related to the fact that we hadn't suffered from the same historical burdens that had been endured in Europe.
In old Europe.
And he wrote about this in his book on American socialism in 1985. This is what's so unique. I mean, often our exceptionalism comes from the absence of a history, the kind of long history that's associated with Europe. It's often linked to the fact that America, and this is another argument that's been made, America was an idea before it was a nation, that essentially all these cosmic claims about American exceptionalism are rooted in America's potential. You know, we are the city on the hill that's about potential, manifest destiny, this idea of the projected population growth, the power that we will acquire, the sense of contentment that comes from the accessibility to land and greater equality, our isolation from fractious European politics. And that's what's so strange about American exceptionalism, because it fits into our idea that we're constantly changing and expanding, but then somehow we're still trapped in an antiquated ideology of agrarian simplicity. So we can have these two very different ideas coexist, even though they're at odds with one another.
Just to add one quick point to that, in the period when the revolutionary, post-revolutionary era, when so much of this oratory, so much of this cultural or moral self-confidence began to evolve, it was sermons that, a lot of them published as pamphlets, that contributed to the language of what we now call American exceptionalism. It wasn't rooted in constitutional thinking. It was rooted in a proud budding tradition of faith. You know, God's providence. Again, it wasn't that the founders were Christian, but they used a vocabulary that had a broad appeal, and so the children of the founders gave godly qualities to the founding generations. That's what we inherited. But those speeches, such as the 4th of July speeches and sermons, they always smacked of a religious adoration and supplication for the revolution. So, you know, we're sometimes not conscious of how language evolves and how the language of political sentiment or sentimentality, patriotism, how it evolves. Here's something I like to say. I wrote a biography of Washington Irving a few years ago. Christmas was largely invented by Washington Irving, not by early Christians. But how many people know that? Thanksgiving wasn't celebrated by pilgrims so much as it was consecrated by Abraham Lincoln in an 1863 effort to seek to restore a sense of nationhood during the Civil War. We have to be careful lest we invent and corrupt our history.
Well, it certainly is fascinating and kind of dangerous, I think, when God is brought into the picture, as we've seen through the years. Listening to what you're saying, I'm reminded of there was the movie Exodus back in 1960, I think, and part of the kind of nationalistic music that went along with that. I remember the lyrics of the song, and this was about the founding of the modern state of Israel in 1948, where it says, "This land is mine. God gave this land to me."
Mm-hmm.
Interesting stuff there. And it kind of doesn't factor in that, hey, there were people living there. There was a whole civilization that was already there. And America, you know, was this big empty continent. I'm reminded of the Turner thesis where you're bringing back some old college memories here. It's been a long time. But, you know, that this was an empty land, that we were kind of on a mission from God, as the Blues Brothers might have said, to civilize this land, to bring this wonderful culture here. And this is from God. How can you question God? Isn't there sort of a danger in that?
Yeah, I mean, that idea of the empty, virgin land, I mean, again, it goes back to the time of the Puritan, even before the Puritan. There was this imagining of, I mean, they imagined the American continent as female. They imagined it as, you know, in these reproductive metaphors.
Supine.
Right, supine, that could be easily seduced and conquered.
Uh-huh.
But the problem with that, as you stated, the land was never empty.
No.
and the fact that this is often what gets lost in the telling of the story of Manifest Destiny.
Yes.
Is this assumption that America had imperial ambitions. In fact, we had imperial ambitions at the time of the American Revolution. One of the episodes we never seem to remember is that we invaded Canada. We assumed that Canada, just like us, is a colonial possession of Great Britain, would want to join our cause.
Of course.
But it also was our first preemptive strike because we were afraid the British might use Canada to attack us. And we had, in a sense, justify using religious language our, you know, conquest of Canada. And this is the other problem Americans have. I mean, Jefferson talked about, you know, the Empire of Liberty or the Empire for Liberty. He used both phrases. But it assumes not only that this is, you know, being led by God or by social forces. I mean, this is what Jefferson liked to argue. He imagined that we will expand. We don't need a strong central government because the forces of demography, the forces of population, will move people westward.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's nice, but it's not the whole story. You still have, you know, the military. You still have treaties that need to be drawn. You still have state forces that are involved in that process of expansion westward. But it's those details. Americans don't like to think of themselves as an empire.
No.
Particularly when they're romanticizing the 19th century, which is the age of Jackson. We don't like to acknowledge our imperial aggressions, how we bought into theories of conquest, and we were becoming more and more like Great Britain than at that time we would want to acknowledge.
And there are a lot of people who still say, what, imperialist? How dare you say the United States is imperialist? We're different from other countries. You know, Britain was imperialist, French. I don't know how England was with their lousy cooking, I have to say, thinking they could rule the world. But they were obviously very imperialistic. And they, you know, as we witnessed recently with that glorious royal wedding, I think they think of themselves as pretty special, kind of God's gift to the planet. And, you know, it seemed to me that, you know, we're not imperialist. We're better than that. And I remember back in college again, long time ago, that the notion came across that the white settlers who came here, part of the idea was for the Puritans, the Pilgrims, and others to get west of history, to leave our history behind and have something new that didn't come with the baggage that we brought, what we carried. It came directly from God himself.
No, but I think that's really true, this idea of starting anew, that somehow we can, you know, escape our past, reinvent ourselves, and then we have this moral legitimacy that God has laid out a program for us, and therefore justifies everything we do. And I think one of the problems is that Americans don't even realize how important land issues were to the founders, the acquisition of land, the acquisition of territory, and that's essential to imperialism. But they're romanticized. We read their words, we quote them, but we never understand their real political motives or their political ambitions.
In the late 18th century, in the Revolutionary era and beyond, the word empire didn't have the connotation it does now.
Hmm.
Americans, in poetry, in opinion pieces, referred to themselves as an infant empire. And they used the metaphor of growth as a positive vocabulary. And they saw themselves, because of this boundless North American continent that they thought was providentially theirs to conquer, that it was they were conquering it for, you know, republicanism, democracy,
sure.
To bring a moral government eventually to the world.
Yes.
Part of that poetry of that era was not only that we were an infant empire to be proud of, that we had the seeds of greatness already in us, but that when our sailors, merchant seamen, would land ashore on distant ports around the world, simply being exposed to the republicanism of those citizens of the United States, foreign countries would learn to want to emulate us.
Yes.
So this sense of American moral greatness goes way, way back. Not to paint it as good or bad, it's something that a culture, well, it makes sense. America was militarily weak, culturally behind the old world of Europe, and they needed a way to feel important as a new nation, and so they mustered this kind of vocabulary, and it was very useful. And increasingly, they became culturally distinct, not just politically distinct from Britain, seizing on, you know, what it is that makes us Americans unique was a long-term process, and for decades, it was chiefly about separating from Great Britain and finding our own voice. And then after that, it became, how do Americans seize on the processes of history and look upon ourselves as the most forward-looking, the most deserving? They even in the mid-19th century began, these enthusiastic opinion makers were writing about how our discoveries of Indian mounds and an Indian history, an Indian past, somehow, gives America a kind of depth, a kind of historical agelessness that makes it akin to the power of the ruins of ancient Greece and Rome. I mean, they were so self-consciously looking for ways to, I mean, even after, you know, trampling over the rights of Indians, taking their land, declaring, you know, this was for the purpose of advancing civilization, and it was inevitable, then they would claim the Indians' past as somehow attaching to America's new greatness. Very interesting.
Very, very interesting. I love learning about history and bringing it out there to listeners and seeing how applicable it may be, because we see things, you know, God bless America, and it does affect very much our present and our future.
Yeah.
We are talking on the Burt Cohen Show with Andrew Burstein and Nancy Eisenberg, professors of history at Louisiana State University, co-authors of Madison and Jefferson, and kind of getting that historical perspective on the notion of the popular idea of American exceptionalism. And I think about the gifts that we kind of, as with a missionary zeal, brought to the world. Of course, the lesser civilizations, largely, frankly, darker civilizations, would welcome us. We were not imperialist. We were benevolent. We were bringing them a gift, American being, bringing it to them. We certainly brought it to the Indians somehow. Sometimes the Native Americans weren't real pleased, and it was so surprising that they didn't want to just roll over and accept a superior civilization, but every now and then they fought back. And then there was, in the mid-19th century, our superiority over the Mexicans. We were liberating and bringing a wonderful culture to the people of what was then Mexico, now, you know, Texas, all the way to California. Then, of course, there was the Spanish-American War, kind of misnamed, but as part of that, we brought our wonderful culture to the people of Hawaii, and the new government that was formed there didn't involve one Hawaiian. It was all white people who became the government. They tossed out and had, you know, virtually no respect for the indigenous Hawaiian culture, the queen that there was there. And certainly the same was true for the Filipinos as part of the Spanish-American War. There was a cartoon I saw of, I believe it was McKinley, who was not yet president, but wading into the water. This is a and it's about communication and words and propaganda, certainly. Here was McKinley wading into the water, holding what was then called a Pacific Negro, because we didn't understand or have any conception of what the Filipinos were really like. Holding a scrub brush, scrubbing this poor baby who was crying, who just didn't understand that we were cleaning him up, bringing him good stuff. Never mind that there was incredible genocide committed there, totally racist genocide. It went on and on and on. So we really believed, tell me if I'm wrong, that we were exceptional and that people who would consider themselves anti-imperialist would support Americans bringing civilization, this light from God to the rest of the world. Is that,
it's not America bashing for historians to go back and reconstruct what really happened. In the Mexican War that you mentioned in 1846-48, Texas became first of all, an independent republic in 1836 and yes. for 9 years before it was annexed. That was about extending slavery into yes. Texas because the Mexican government, which became independent from Spain around 1821, in its constitution outlawed slavery. So the Americans in Texas could not thrive without the institution of slavery, and they got around it. They got around it by calling their slaves indentured servants, and the Mexicans winked at it for a while. But, increasingly, the Texians, as they were known mm-hmm. back then, saw that the government of Mexico was going to enforce its political will. And, it wasn't just about, this sort of good-natured, good-hearted, Western ambition that is sometimes a disguise for imperialism. There is a dark side, and, it doesn't reduce our history. It doesn't make us anti-American, which is what the ideologues today have such a problem with, to encounter the past the way it really was. And to understand it in context, not to read, as Glenn Beck would say, you read the founding fathers' letters or statements, and you don't need a historian to interpret it. It's like this evangelical pose that the founders can speak to you like God can speak to you, and you don't need the interposition of ministers or historians. And, this kind of laxity, that it doesn't matter, it just, history is what you want it to be, and, historians are somehow, these sort of bubble-headed people who want to, diminish the American present for some ungodly reason, right?
Mm. Well, what about, so much, it seems to me, of the American identity throughout the 19th, 20th, and now 21st century is about exceptionalism, that, there's still a lot of people who believe that we were basically in the right in the war in Vietnam. We were fighting the godless, monolithic communists, Moscow Peking, it was called at the time, Link. It didn't happen to be true at all, but that we were kind of a civilizing force there, and that, if we just had these, it was the politicians, the anti-war people Otherwise, without that resistance in America, if we had fought well, we would have won, and Vietnam would have been the better for it. And it just goes on and on and on. We had, you know, our American history, a lot of people don't want to look at Central America and South America, Chile and El Salvador, Nicaragua, these places, which I think maybe part of our American exceptionalism kind of had the effect of encouraging major resistance that might not have been as strong otherwise. I remember when Evo Morales was elected in Bolivia, I asked a Bolivian specialist, would Morales have been elected had it not been for George Bush? And she laughed and thought, yes, probably, but he did a lot better. So this American exceptionalism can kind of perhaps not be in American interests. Your response right. to that?
Nancy? Yeah, I mean, I think you raised several points, and one of the things your comments remind me, particularly when you're talking about Vietnam and the whole Cold War paradigm, when it was often portrayed, it's, you know, democracy versus communism, and that communism was reaching around the globe, and only democracy, this idea that it's two competing world systems.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that actually has a much older history. It goes back to the way people talked about race between Europeans and Native Americans in the 19th century. And then, believe it or not, people forget it was appropriated during the Civil War, that North and South were two competing civilizations that couldn't coexist. And it was about the future of the nation. Do we want the nation to look like the North, being, you know, progressive, capitalist, or do we want it to be like the South?
Yeah.
So even the tropes that people use to explain American exceptionalism have a history. And people never understand that history. Just assume that, you know, we're talking about one particular period. And most Americans' notions are limited to the 20th century.
Yeah.
There's very little that where people know, that, you know, in a more in-depth way about the language or where these ideas come from. Because this is why history is important, because things are often reinvented and repackaged. And we need to understand that. Hmm. And you're also right about how American exceptionalism can work against America's self-interest.
Absolutely.
Because we are perceived as, you know, whether we're perceived as a nation that is a bully and a power. I mean, this is what begins in the 20th century, that we're, you know, if you think about Daniel Bell's critique, The End of American Exceptionalism, he talked about how the idea of our moral superiority had been shattered. And we may be a power, but we're a power that isn't very effective or productive or reliable. So I think that there's the way in which European nations look on American exceptionalism. They can view it as a liability. It can be wearing blinders, or that America, in a sense, is like the emperor without clothes. And I think that this is something that Americans themselves, and this is why people are so desperately claiming exceptionalism now, because it's a fear that it is disappearing. It's a fear that we you know, don't have the authority that we should have because we're this divinely ordained nation, and that by screaming and yelling it from the rooftop, somehow we're going to reclaim it. But it's not true.
Yeah, well, it's so much easier to believe myth than actual history. It's a lot more fun, too. Now, one way that it seems to me that America kind of has been exceptional is that it seems that in most other Western nations, there largely has been a sense of class consciousness. And that when my grandparents came here, it seemed they thought, and they were incredibly hopeful and did, frankly, pretty well, because there was not this black and white separation between the upper class, the aristocracy, and everybody else. There was something possible here, unlike other countries, called a middle class. And there has really been no sense of working class consciousness, no sense of solidarity that we have seen in other countries. And as a result, there's been basically no left in America, despite what the right wing people insist. And I wonder if you could talk a bit, and Nancy, you talked earlier about our labor situation, our labor structure being a bit different. Isn't that somewhat exceptional, that people felt like they didn't need to identify with the working class. In fact, people that would normally in other countries identify with the working class often identify and throw their lot with the very wealthiest in our society and vote against their own self-interest as a class. If you could speak to that.
Yeah, historians have studied this issue, and one of the interesting things they found is that if you go back to the 19th century, that what's different about Europe is that the United States, class discontent was channeled into party politics, where, European class-based movements were attached to unions, involved, a higher degree of union membership. They did develop a kind of class consciousness where our class identity gets channeled into party politics, and that's why it even invokes American exceptionalism or Americanism. And that does affect class politics in a very distinctive way. And even that the fact that this transition happens earlier in the 19th century, where European class politics emerges later in historical development. And some have argued that it's also about the power of the state and the way in which class politics, that European nations are more developed, they were much more engaged in promoting internal improvements than the federal government was in the 19th century. And there's a more visible enemy. But I think that's part of the problem, is that class politics takes on the rhetoric that's played out in party politics, where it's a battle between the federal government and state government. It uses a different rhetoric, and you're exactly right. That leads to not developing the same kind of class consciousness or class labor politics or socialist politics that emerges in Europe.
One of the things that distinguishes the American spirit historically and still today is our embrace of individualism, the spirit of individualism. It has dominated American society since the 1820s, 1830s. European travelers such as Alexis de Tocqueville, Francis Trollope, came and wrote extensively about what it was about Americans in the time of Jackson distinguished them. The idea that anyone can grow up to be president, that there's a lack of deference to traditional authority or an aristocracy, people of rank, anybody can make it, and that is part of a key transitional moment in American history, which is why the 1820s and 1830s are we can look at as the beginning of a modern American ideal, and how this relates to exceptionalism is that it can, when you celebrate the individual and the nation is a collection of self-conscious individualism, then you bring to that this fear and loathing of outsiders and the fear of acknowledging weakness or declension. And so you become stronger and stronger in your embrace of what it is that makes you a moral civilization. The Chinese, just to give a cultural comparison, have always, but especially in the Maoist and post-Maoist eras, invoked 5,000 years of history, the longest continuous history of any civilization, to offset their rural poverty, the corruption in government, a culture that's beset by greed and power grabbing and violence. They have this ideal of being the oldest civilization, from which other civilizations in Asia grew and borrowed. The Japanese took their written language from the Chinese ideographs. And, every great continental power, the Chinese, the Americans, possess this kind of love, hate, fear, anxiety, dynamic, where the more they feel contained, the more they feel abused, victimized, the more they fear their own declension, the more they lash out and declare their moral, uprightness. Excessive self-confidence.
Yeah, I mean, one other thing, that the whole idea that we, the celebration of individualism, I mean, you think about how, Benjamin Franklin, became in the 19th century this image of the self-made man. There's several things we forget about that mythology. We forget, and this is, what's interesting is this is what abolitionists realized in the early 19th century. They realized where America might celebrate this idea of social mobility, even the early Republican Party of Abraham Lincoln celebrated this idea of social mobility, but our class mobility was offset by the fact that we created a very rigid caste society based on race and gender.
Yes.
I mean, the idea of social mobility was linked to men, not linked to women.
Oh, yeah.
Women's only idea of mobility was who they could marry. If they could marry up, therefore they could experience social mobility, not by being creative, not by being ambitious, not by being productive.
Right.
And there's no need. I mean, we know the long history of race in this country, not only from slavery, but in Reconstruction, post-Reconstruction, how we had to ensure this, caste-based society on race. So this is the really unfortunate side, that social mobility is premised on keeping the majority of the population, because women are 50% of the population, and then blacks, in a marginalized position.
Well, I wonder then about, among the people that counted, the white males who are, white males who owned property originally, and then that changed. Isn't there, in fact, more social mobility? I mean, Jews, Germans, Catholics, Protestants, well, maybe not so much Jews, I suppose, but could, well, no, in reality, there was, in fact, social mobility. We did enter into the American dream to a large extent, and doesn't that make us...
But even ethnicity, social mobility, I mean, I just sort of taught this in my class. I was teaching The Bread Givers by Anzi Jezierska. I mean, for ethnic social mobility, it requires assimilation. It means almost denying your ethnic past or concealing it or making yourself acceptable so that you become an American.
Right.
we're not as accepting of diversity as we might imagine. And the fact that at the same time as sun groups, and this is even true in terms of, the blacks and African Americans, the talented tenth, there are some that are allowed to succeed and be allowed to be successful, but they must separate themselves from the larger group. They're kind of the minority successful part, where when you talk about ethnic groups, that the ethnic hordes are still somehow dangerous and bringing us down. So there's even a dark side to social mobility, because it's about rejecting your ethnic identity to a certain degree.
Yeah.
And it's also about separating yourself from where you came from.
Right.
And even leaving your past in the old world,
right,
so that you can make yourself anew. So I think it's very complicated when we talk about social mobility.
This notion of ethnicity and social mobility is a very engaging one,
sure,
especially today, because denying one's descent, becoming American, assimilating and denying one's descent only works, it appears, for those who are European-derived Americans,
sure,
because this is about our bleak racial past. Racist past, and of a piece with this whole birther business that we've had to endure recently, because, and Nancy and I just finished a piece for Salon on Obama's patriarchal descent and maternal descent, and the birthers keep insisting that to be an American, your descent is through the patriarchal line, and so even though his Midwestern mother raised him, Barack Obama is the product of an impure, un-American, unexceptional, shall we say, descent, line of descent. Because if you tie everything to, to patrimony, to patriarchy,
yes,
then his mother is lost in the equation. And, you know, it's a matter of physiognomy compounded by these vestigial notions of the importance of, you know, the paternal line of descent.
Wow. We are talking. You know, go ahead.
So birtherism and American exceptionalism are actually, in an odd way, interconnected.
Well, he is the other, after all. He can't really be president because, well, maybe he's not so exceptional in that he is one of the world. His father was from Kenya, as they keep reminding us. We are talking on the Bert Cohen Show with Professors Andrew Burstein and Nancy Eisenberg, professors of history at Louisiana State University, co-authors of Madison and Jefferson, about the question of American exceptionalism. Now, what would be, is our identity as Americans endangered if we are not exceptional? You know, the other side throws at us all the time that, you know, if you're looking at real American history, if you're questioning the official party line, which sounds kind of, you know, yeah, foreign to me, but then you're anti-American. Can you question American exceptionalism and still, can we have a proud, useful identity and a brand, if you will?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are some people who feel that it will be lost if you question it. They don't believe in dissent, even though, I mean, as most scholars have also recognized, it's kind of ridiculous to assume that all Americans are alike. I mean, there's regional diversity.
Oh, yeah.
There are particularities that make people in different parts of the country who live in different states, you know, local identities. And to assume that we create an artificial national boundary and somehow there's a, you know, a unique culture that doesn't overflow those boundaries, you know, scholars have studied borderlands, is really kind of silly. But it is, people, if you believe it from this idea of faith and providence, that if we failed in our mission, that if we're not unique and we're not special, many feel, what does America have left?
Right,
and
right.
I think part of the problem is goes back to this idea of thinking of America as an idea before it's a nation. To think that, you know, if that ideology, if that mythology is compromised, and so much has been invested into defending this ideology, into claiming that this is, you know, essential to why we're unique, and many of the things that were first asserted that made us are unique are no longer unique anymore. You know, the fact that the frontier closed, since land was so important to claiming our uniqueness. This idea of simplicity and moral purity, we can't really claim that, or being isolationists, somehow no longer a part of the international political scene.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that idea no longer really holds true. I mean, even in the 19th century, where it's overblown and exaggerated and you know, not really reflecting a reality, but at least some of the elements there, you know, still had a resemblance, or still had a means that people could point to them, that this is still somewhat makes us unique. Well, all those old markers, all those old symbols no longer really hold true. And I think that's why people are sort of so desperate to try to, you know, force American exceptionalism and defend it, and seem intent on pushing it forward, where it sounds like someone who's you know, weeping or looking back nostalgically for this lost ideal, and are going to insist on it, even though all the facts contradict what they're saying.
The problem with the sensible discourse that you'd like to have and we'd like to have about this question of American exceptionalism is that, as I mentioned earlier, in today's political environment, it's become a litmus test.
Oh, yeah.
And that, it, you know, if you don't declare that you believe in American exceptionalism, you are somehow denying not just the cultural distinctiveness of America, but what they really mean is the superiority, the cultural superiority of America. And when you equate American exceptionalism with American superiority, you tap into all kinds of existing fears. You know, is this going to be the American century or the Chinese century? That sort of thing.
Right.
The danger is that Americans are internalizing this in unhelpful ways. The idea, you know, it extends to the idea that we're entitled to tell other people what to do because we know what's best for them because we're smarter or more civilized or more morally upright than they are. And, you know, President Obama himself feels obligated to end every speech with God bless the United States of America because he knows that rituals support national mythologies. They're like chants or prayers, and they're designed to make people feel good, to feel more secure about the endurance of their moral community. And when you exist in such an anxious political environment as we do now, it's really hard to have that historically informed, sensible conversation. I wish we could. At the moment, it seems very hard to do.
Well, it does certainly appear that in the ongoing culture war, that the cultural and political right uses American exceptionalism as a way to discredit any Americans who dare disagree or dare question it. We are talking with Andrew Burstein and Nancy Eisenberg about American exceptionalism. And I spoke with a former colleague of mine from the New Hampshire State Senate. We worked together on a lot of things. She's a bit more toward the right. I asked her what the term American exceptionalism means, because she's a strong believer in American exceptionalism. She says, what the term means to me is America's ongoing vision of inclusion and progress and our belief that anything is possible because of it. Our forefathers somehow saw the great potential of a truly free and inclusive society. It's our continued determination to work toward their vision despite our imperfections and setbacks. That is, to me, truly exceptional. Your reaction to that?
That sounds great.
That sounds nice, and we might connect it to the, you know, the Statue of Liberty. But at the same time, that, you know, the Statue of Liberty was being built, and, you know, it was very difficult to finally get the funding to put it up. You forget about the National Origins Act of 1924, where we put a series of restrictions on immigrants. We created a hierarchy of nations. No Asians whatsoever were allowed in the country. People immigrating from Northern European were allowed in a greater percentage than other people from other nationalities. So this myth of inclusion just doesn't hold up to the facts.
Yeah. You know? Well, yeah.
There are moments when we might imagine ourselves as being inclusive, but there's plenty of history to show that when it comes to African Americans, to blacks, that we weren't inclusive. We, in a sense, in the 19th century, this is why the Republican, even people like Abraham Lincoln, supported colonization. They believed the model was that free blacks should migrate out of the United States, establish their own republics elsewhere, but that the nation ultimately has to become a homogenous Anglo-Saxon society. That's not about inclusion.
But what your friend said really does encapsulate what I think most Americans agree are American values. And you can find, certainly, in our founding documents, this embrace of, maybe not truly free, as she said, but inclusive. They saw America as what they used the word asylum, meaning an asylum for the poor huddled masses yearning to breathe free. They did envision America as a place where our temperate environment, our republican institutions would produce a progressive, inclusive, a place that's better than the impoverished, disease-ridden cities of Europe. And then part of that was the ability for someone to come over here with no money and then become a landowner and get ahead and do it by being neighborly and, so all that kind
of... Living a good life, sure.
Yeah, that Walt Whitman, Robert Frost sort of... It's an oversimplified picture of America, but it is something that down deep, even, the most hardened critical historian finds easy to embrace. But what the bad part of all this, of course, is opportunism, and that, it leads to a kind of hubris. Hard to find that proper balance that allows the American exceptionalism to flourish that we equate with our good values, and yet the exploitative element in a society where, you know, instead of there being an aristocracy, it's really a moneyed elite. So our values are wonderful, but they are very, very hard to sustain in the way that freedom is manipulated.
But, you know, you also raise another point. Another scholar has raised that sometimes American exceptionalism is so vague that people can claim it means different things, really radically different things, that often can be in opposition to one another, whether it's about exclusion or inclusion. I mean, that's a perfect example. Some people want American exceptionalism to be exclusive, you know, that it's a certain race of people who should run this country and define its cultural values. I mean, even in the 1790s, we get the Alien and Sedition Acts, where the dangerous foreigners were the French. So that's also kind of what scholars have argued can be positive, because new people coming to this country can embrace exceptionalism, define it to their needs to support their class mobility or social mobility. But it also, it's part of that mythology that if it can be, people from really different political perspectives can claim it of its own, this also allows it to be perpetuated, because people could think, well, I'm, you know, I identify with America and I believe in exceptionalism. But once we start laying out what those principles are, we realize, wow, this, we don't agree at all. But I think the vagueness allows all people to feel they can make some kind of claim to American exceptionalism, which is also why it never quite goes away.
Hmm. As we began our discussion, we were talking about this revolutionary era and how American patriots needed a vocabulary, needed a brand, because they were competing for global stature when they were a minor blip on the map.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where American exceptionalism really arose, as a way of establishing that they weren't merely the colonial offspring of a great empire, but an infant empire in embryonic form. That's what Thomas Paine was writing about. That's what national poets were writing in epic verse. It grew out of a sense of inferiority. And now American exceptionalism, ironically, is an expression of, you know, tremendous arrogance. So looking at the historical antecedents is a fascinating way of coming to terms with who we are as a people, who we were as a people, and instead of looking to the founders as somehow possessing an ability to sanctify American exceptionalism, we should look at it, you know, through this close, long-term evolutionary process of this concept, and then maybe, as a people, we'll be able to have that civilized conversation we'd all like to have.
Well, thank you very much. Very, very interesting. We could go on for at least another hour on this subject, and we've seen, you know, countries that feel inferior act sort of badly in the playground over the years. But anyway, we could talk much more about that. If people are interested in following and looking at some of your works, you wrote a book, I believe the title is Madison and Jefferson, published by Random House. What other things might they look at?
I've published six other books on early American culture. I'm best known as a Jefferson scholar, and my most recent work on Jefferson is called Jefferson's Secrets. And I also, in 2007, published a biography of Washington Irving called The Original Knickerbocker. I'll let Nancy give you her.
Sure.
Yeah, before Madison and Jefferson, I published a biography of Aaron Burr called Fallen Founder, The Life of Aaron Burr, published by Viking. And my first book was on the women's rights movement, talking about American constitutionalism in the antebellum period, called Sex and Citizenship in Antebellum America. And, you know, we tend to write about a variety of different things. I've written about Patty Hearst, written about other things. But
And you're at Louisiana State University.
Yes, yes. And we have, you know, websites where people could find all our publications.
All right. Well, and that website you would suggest in the last minute would be?
Well, you could go to the LSU History Department website. My personal website is andburstein, The website is the Louisiana State University History Department.
We'll look at that, and thank you so much.
Yeah, just go to Louisiana History Department.
Louisiana History Department. All right, thank you.
Yes, LSU.
LSU, and certainly Louisiana has an interesting history, that is for sure. All right, thank you so much for being with us today. Very informative. Hopefully it can inform our future as well. Thank you so much.
Very much enjoyed the conversation, Bert.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, thank you.